The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Folks, thanks for coming despite the inclement weather. My name is Andy. I'm the Director of Author Events here, and I am ecstatic to introduce our following guest. Ken Follett doesn't want to hear this, but I've been reading his book since I was knee-high to a bookworm. Eye of the Needle, Triple, and The Keys to Rebecca were the first thrillers I'd read, and in my mind lingers some of the most exciting reading experiences I've had. In an informal poll I took earlier, everyone I had asked had read one of Ken Follett's books, and I assume that everyone in here has read at least one, if not 10, maybe 15. He's making a brief and rare stop in Philadelphia today for his new book, Mondo Senza Fine, or as we say in English, World Without End. It's an honor to welcome Ken Follett.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, folks. It's good to see you. Oh, that's not my speech. That's a train ticket. It's a pleasure to be here. Last time I was in Philadelphia was on a research trip for The Third Twin, which is set in Baltimore, but it has some scenes in Philadelphia. So I had a pleasant day mooching around looking at locations. And it's nice to be back. It's good to see you. Somebody said, when you finished The Pillars of the Earth, did you know then that you were going to write a sequel? And the answer to that is certainly not. And if I had known in 1989 that I had to write a sequel, I might have thrown myself off a cliff, because The Pillars of the Earth was a very difficult book to write. And when I came to the end of it, I was exhausted in a way that I have never been in my writing career. I felt as if I had imagination fatigue. It's a long book, The Pillars of the Earth, 375,000 words, and the trouble with a long book is that you have to keep on making up more and more stuff about the same characters. Much easier to stop at 100,000 words and start again, start a new book with a new group of characters and a new situation. The upside, of course, is that if a long book, if it's good, is satisfying in a much deeper way than a short book. And I say if it's good because, of course, we've all had the experience of a long book that isn't very good, and you keep looking, how many more pages have I got to go through? But if the author succeeds in drawing us into the imaginary world, then we love a long book and we don't want it to end. And some people have said to me about The Pillars of the Earth, I didn't want it to end, which is quite a compliment when you consider that it's a book of more than 1,000 pages. So that's the upside. And I think that's because a short book like a thriller or a regular length novel is like a snapshot of the principal characters at some point in their lives. And a long book, a saga, can show you the person's whole life. So in The Pillars of the Earth and in World Without End, we see the principal characters as children or as young people, and we see them grow and mature. We see them as adolescents and lovers and husbands and wives, all the way through to maturity or old age. And there is something very satisfying about that. I spent 3 years and 3 months writing The Pillars of the Earth, and actually that understates it, because after 2 years, I only had 200 pages, and I kind of panicked. I thought it was going to go on forever, like General Hospital, and so I started to work 6 days a week and then 7 days a week at it, just in order to get it finished one day. Actually, that was quite a good experience, working that intensely with no breaks on a book, and I managed then to write a great deal and rewrite a great deal in just a year and a quarter. All the same, it was a long time before I was ready for another book of that length. It's like running a marathon. Not that I've ever run a marathon, as you can tell from my figure, but people who have run a marathon say that afterwards you forget the pain and remember the great side of it, and then you want to do it again. My mother used to say that about having children, actually. She used to say if women remembered what childbirth was like for very long, they would never do it more than once. So it was a long time before I was ready to do this again. But I really did want to do it again because of the way that people talk to me about the Pillars of the Earth and how special a book it is to people. Some people say it's the best book I've ever read, which is a very serious compliment. And some people have read the book two or three times, which is also very unusual. And so it became clear to me that I'd done something in the Pillars of the Earth which was superior in some ways to anything else that I had written. And I really wanted to see whether I could do that again. The movies have given sequels a bad name, of course. Rocky 17 or whatever, wherever we are now. But best-selling books have always had sequels. Mark Twain wrote Tom Sawyer Abroad. The first novel ever written, but before I say its name, I wonder if you know or would care to guess what is the first novel ever written. If you whisper, I won't hear. Sing out, shout out. Robinson Crusoe. Now, that's an interesting choice because I think that's probably the first novel written in English. It was published in 1719, and it did also have a sequel, The Further Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. They'd normally now published both novels in one volume. But there's an earlier novel. Somebody said Don Juan, but you mean Don Quixote, don't you? I can't see who's speaking, but thank you very much. Yeah, I think Don Quixote is probably the first novel ever written. It was published in 1609. Or thereabouts, and rapidly translated from the Spanish into several other European languages. I have a theory that Shakespeare must have read Don Quixote, actually, because he was alive, he was living in London. This was the literary sensation of the time, and it would be surprising if he hadn't. However, Don Quixote also had a sequel, The Further Adventures of Don Quixote, and that too is also now normally published in one volume. And there are more examples. Shakespeare wrote Henry IV, Part II, and even God wrote the New Testament. I'll tell you a story about sequels. It may not be a true story, but it's quite funny, so I'll tell you anyway. There used to be a television producer in England called Lou Grade, nicknamed Low Grade, because it was thought that he produced rubbish television. And the story is that he wanted to move his image up market, and so he announced that he was going to make three long-form television dramas based on the Bible, one about the creation, one about the nativity, and one about the resurrection. And he was going to call them God, Son of God, and Return of the Son of God. Well, World Without End is Son of the Pillars of the Earth, and one day I might write Return of the Son of the Pillars of the Earth. It's a sequel in the sense that it's set in the same town as the Pillars of the Earth, but it's set 200 years later and features the descendants of the characters in the Pillars of the Earth. And the central theme, Pillars of the Earth, the theme was architecture and building. And in World Without End, the theme is medicine, because in 1348, there was a plague called the Black Death, which devastated Western civilization. It killed probably a third and maybe a half of the population of Europe and the Middle East and North Africa. So this happens in the middle of World Without End. It's a terrific drama, because you just have to imagine the street you're living in. One person in three is killed by some terrible disease. But it also, it's the theme of World Without End in another sense, because the Black Death changed the way people thought. It discredited conventional medicine. Medieval medicine was based on the writings of the ancients, Galen and Hippocrates, and students of medicine at Oxford University read these ancient texts and debated them. They didn't see patients. So the physicians of the Middle Ages were astonishingly incompetent. I went through a famous book, a text on medieval medicine called Taddeo Aldotti and His Disciples, and I made a table of symptoms, medieval diagnosis, modern diagnosis, medieval treatment, and I showed it to my daughter, who's a doctor, and said, could you tell me which of these medieval treatments would have done any good? Well, one of their treatments was to wash wounds with wine. And, of course, wine is alcohol is an antiseptic, so that would have done some good. It was the only medieval treatment that I could find that actually would have benefited the patient. And I then subsequently asked one of my advisors, Sam Cohn, a university professor who is an expert in the Black Death, I asked him to name one medieval treatment that would actually cure a disease, and he was not able to. So medieval medicine was terrible. The Black Death discredited it, and people started to think about medicine in a different way. They started to observe the patient, make notes. In other words, a more scientific method. And it's possible to see that change after the Black Death as the beginning of the process that led to the development of science and the Enlightenment. And the other big consequence, intellectual consequence of the Black Death, was a change in people's attitude to religion. People began to think of religion as a personal encounter with God rather than as a ritual that was performed by a priesthood. Needless to say, the priesthood fought very hard against this change. But Wycliffe, William Wycliffe, lived through the Black Death. And he was the first person to translate the Bible into English, and he began that work after the Black Death. And 150 years later, Martin Luther started the Reformation. So it's possible to see this human trauma of the Black Death as initiating the intellectual revolutions which came later. And so that is, as it were, the underlying theme. Of course, what World Without End is about most of the time is a group of families and their quarrels and ambitions, their love affairs and their hatreds and their revenge and their conflicts, because that's the kind of thing that all novels are about. But I've been talking about, as it were, the historical background that informs that. And I think nowadays readers, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you could write a novel that was just about some families. And some of our classics are just like that. Buddenbrooks, the great German novel by Thomas Mann, is just about a family. And the Forsyte Saga would be the English equivalent, also about a family. But in modern times, a novel of this type has to be about more than a family. So The Godfather, for example, one of the great bestsellers of the last 50 years, The Godfather, is, of course, about a family, but it's also about something else. It's also about organized crime. Roots, another great long novel about a family, is also about slavery. And so my feeling was that my readers would want both. They want a saga, a drama about people and their emotions, but they also want, and I feel this myself as a reader, it's very satisfying to put a book down, I think, and say, well, that was great, and I really enjoyed it, and I understand something that I didn't understand before. So that's what I've tried to do with World Without End and with The Pillars of the Earth. And, of course, the conflicts, a lot of the conflicts in World Without End come from these changes, because whenever there are changes, there are people who resist them. And so the conflicts in World Without End tend to be between people who accept that the world has got to change and people who don't accept that and fight against it. And I'll just finish by saying I think that is not such a medieval theme at all. It's really quite a modern theme, and that's the kind of conflict that we're still struggling with today. So that's the book. That's World Without End. And I hope you're all going to enjoy it. I hope you're all going to buy it or borrow it from the library and enjoy it. And if you have any questions to ask me, I would be very happy to answer them for a few minutes. Yes, sir. Oh, well, just hold on a minute. We have a microphone because this is being recorded. So when I point to you, you can't ask the question immediately. You have to wait for a sprinter. Okay, yes, please.
Thank you for coming to Philadelphia and the Free Library. I know your wife is a member of the cabinet, and you've written political modern thrillers. Have you considered writing a book about contemporary politics? And if so, what would be the theme?
Well, you're partly right. My wife is a member of Parliament, and she is a minister in the government, but she isn't actually a member of the cabinet, which is a more elevated kind of minister, although who knows what the future holds. But, of course I've been involved in politics for a long time now, and most of the people in the British government for the last 10 years have been friends of mine. So obviously when I write about the Middle Ages, when I write about people in power, or when I write about an election in the monastery, in the Middle Ages the monks had the right to elect their prior. So there's an election in World Without End, and there was one in the Pillars of the Earth as well. And of course I think about my experience in modern politics and my knowledge of powerful people, prime ministers and cabinet ministers and so on. I never actually model characters directly on real-life people. That doesn't work for me. But I use bits of people. And, in fact, my family are often amused to see odd bits of themselves, the gestures or phrases or quirks that they have reproduced in characters. So, yes, I've used everything that I know about politics and public life without actually writing about real-life people, or indeed writing about modern politics. I'm not sure how much fun it would be. It's much more fun. I think an election in the Middle Ages, I find really interesting and intriguing. I'm not sure I could make an election, a 21st century British election, quite so much fun for the reader. And another question, anybody? This lady down here, who's got the mic?
You mentioned the theme of cathedral building in your Pillars of the Earth. I presume your new book, Medicine and Your Daughter, maybe have a tie-in. I'm interested in how you came to the architecture theme. Was that there first, or did it evolve from the story?
Yes, my interest in architecture led to the Pillars of the Earth. I was interested particularly in medieval architecture and the great Gothic cathedrals. And really, the impetus for the Pillars of the Earth came from me standing outside one of these great buildings and thinking, why is it here? It's huge, it's very beautiful, and it's been here for 800 years. But why? We all know that the Middle Ages was a comparatively primitive time, that people were very poor by comparison with ourselves. They had no power tools. They had to do everything with hammer and chisel. And, of course, they didn't have the mathematics to understand the stresses in a tall building. It all had to be done by guesswork. I mean, they had some ideas about stresses, but they were all wrong, really, their ideas. So I would stand outside a cathedral and think, what is the story of this? And, of course, the answer is very complicated. You can't answer the question why the cathedral's there in anything less than 375,000 words. And so the Pillars of the Earth, amongst other things, explains how that enormous church served so many different interests within the community and how it had so many different functions. It wasn't just used for worship by any means. And so the idea really grew from the fascination with architecture, yeah. Another question? This lady in the front, please.
Thank you. How do you come up with the names for your characters?
Well, I think a central character should have an unusual name, maybe a made-up name. And so in World Without End, the principal hero is a woman called Caris, and I thought of Caris because of the word charisma and chrism. You know, Caris is linked with ideas of charm and also with ideas of magical power. And it also had quite a nice sound. And actually, when I was thinking of it, I was giving a talk to a small group of American high school students who were visiting London, and I asked them what they thought of it, and they said it was great, so that decided me. And the main male character in World Without End is Merthyn, and I wanted him to have a made-up name because I think it indicates the specialness of the person. And Merthyn is halfway between Mervyn, which is a common Welsh name, and Merlin, which is the name of a famous magician. So that appealed to me in that way. And then as the characters become... There's a character called Gwenda, which is a made-up name, but it sounds as if it might be a real name. That's my current theory, anyway, is that if the character is really special, they should have a really special name. And then you can use ordinary names for the lesser people. I think with World Without End, I actually made a spreadsheet of all the characters. There are more than 200 named characters in World Without End. It won't seem, I hope, it won't seem confusing when you read it, I promise. Because, I worked that out. But I didn't actually notice that I had called four minor characters Richard. And actually nobody else noticed except the Italian translator. None of my English-speaking readers noticed that. That's a hazard. The spreadsheet should have brought that to my attention, but somehow it didn't. I do a spreadsheet. I'm going to do it for every book now because I really like it. What it did for me was the spreadsheet calculated the ages of the characters in every chapter, so that there was less possibility of my making a mistake and having, 10 years later, having somebody only 5 years older, which is the kind of thing that authors do all the time. Another question? This lady?
Yes, first of all, thank you for being here. This is such a treat. And I saw you on CBS Sunday Morning this past Sunday at Westminster Abbey. That was exciting. And I know a lot of people ask you this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, about your future projects. Would you be doing more spy novels, which I loved, and I also love Pillars of the Earth. Would you do more medieval or historic or both, or how do you decide that?
Well, I think the answer to that is probably yes and yes. I'm sure I'll do more spy stories. And one of these days, I'll return to the Middle Ages. You know, if something's working for me, then I'm happy to do it again. I've done four novels set in the time of the Second World War. I enjoy it. The readers like those novels very much. And, there must be 1,000 more stories to be told about the Second World War. It's a time of great heroism. It's a very unusual war in that we still believe it was a war of the good guys against the bad guys. You know, there really was something important at stake, and people did sacrifice their lives for something really important, which you can't say about every war that we've ever been involved in. So, I'll go back to World War II, and I'm sure I'll go back to the Middle Ages, but perhaps not yet. I'll have a little break. This lady?
Yes, I have a question about the historical accuracy of the kings, Queen Maud, King Stephen. Are they actually correctly placed in your books historically? I mean, sometimes I think I should look this up in some kind of a historical book and check. Was there really a King Stephen at that year?
Absolutely.
So I can trust all of these kings and queens?
You can trust me. You don't need to look it up.
Okay.
My philosophy on that is that everything... anything about real-life people... should be based on the historical record. Of course, if I have them speak, I have conversations, then I assume the reader will know that that's invented because because there are no conversations recorded from that period of time. But if I say that there was a civil war between King Stephen and the Empress Maud, then there absolutely was. And if I say that he fought a battle, the battle in the middle of the Pillars of the Earth, there's the Battle of Lincoln, 1141. And my description of that battle is accurate. Everything that I say happened in that battle in general really happened, although there may be a fictional character involved in it, and what he does is obviously fictional, but it would never contradict what actually happened. In World Without End, the big battle in the center of the novel is the famous Battle of Crécy in northern France, and that... One of my advisors on World Without End is a specialist on the Battle of Crécy. That is her entire academic study. And everything that happens in World Without End at the Battle of Crécy really happened in real life, according to the historical record. So I would never do anything that would contradict the historical record. And I think two reasons for that. One, somebody might notice. But the other is that I think, as readers, we know when the author is making it up. I think there's a sense you get that he doesn't know what he's talking about. And conversely, when an author is familiar with the background material, whether it's historical or technical or whatever it is, when the author's familiar with the background material, I think you can tell, and you get a sort of sense of his or her confidence in the material. So for both those reasons, I think it's important to be accurate in these matters. Do we have time for one more question? Maybe this lady here.
For those of us who are not so sure, could you tell us, medically speaking, what is the Black Plague, and if it was so virulent, how did it die out?
For a long time, people thought that the Black Death was an illness that is today known as the bubonic plague, which is carried by fleas that live on rats. That theory has recently been discredited, and not many historians now believe that. They're not quite so sure what it actually was. Some people think it may well have been a virus, a hemorrhagic virus, because there's a lot of the descriptions of people dying of the Black Death describe them bleeding, having nosebleeds and that sort of thing, internal bleeding and so on. So it may well have been that kind of virus. The second part of your question was, how did it die out? It came back about every 12 or 15 years for hundreds of years. It wasn't just 1348, although 1348 was the worst instance of it. It came back again and again for hundreds of years. Each time it came back, it seems to have killed fewer people. That was certainly partly because the human race figured out how to deal with it and how to restrict it. Even as early as the first outbreak, people experimented with things like wearing a face mask. Doctors and nurses, nuns wearing a face mask when they were dealing with patients and washing their hands in vinegar, all of which are effective, if you know, simple methods of stopping infection. And it may well be also that the human race, or at any rate a part of the human race, began to develop an immunity. And I think probably what happened is that the group of people vulnerable to the plague grew smaller and smaller until it was too small for the disease's cycle to survive. And the last instance is the famous Plague of London in 1665. The last instance in Western Europe, anyway. And after that, it just never came back. And something that had been a curse on the human race for 300 years just disappeared. We think it never went beyond Europe and the Middle East. as far as we know. So, for example, we don't think it went to sub-Saharan Africa. And there is a theory, and it's a very speculative theory, that many Europeans and North Africans may have an immunity to AIDS that is actually descended from their immunity to the Black Death. And that may be why sub-Saharan Africa has suffered so badly from AIDS, much more severely than North Africa and Europe. That is a very speculative theory. Nobody knows if that's true, and we may never know. But that's the idea that it never spread as far. It didn't cross the Sahara Desert, is the basic theory. So that's the Black Death, and may it never come back. And that's my talk. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your questions. Am I going to have time to sign a few books for people? Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.